Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Getting back into gear after a week off in the woods of central Massachusetts. And I'm saying good morning to New Haven Mayor Tony Harp.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Mayor Harp is here in the studio for her regular Mayor Monday checkup on what she and we in New Haven are up to. So join the conversation by posting a question on our New Haven Independent Facebook page or call in at 203-872-7ELM. 203-872-7356. Today's program is made possible in part thanks to support from Bertram Moses and Gateway Community College. Thanks, Gateway. Thanks, Bertram. And thanks, Mayor Harp. So nice to see you on Monday morning.
It's great to be here. Good to see you, too.
And to get right into it, I and others will be seeing you at 3:30 today outside City Hall. It's Monday, August 21st, by the way, because people... just so you know, people listen to this show on days after. We are live on August 21st on Monday, and on this date at 3:30, there's a community rally planned in response to the events in Charlottesville, Virginia, a little more than a week ago. Do I have that right, Mayor Harp?
Yes, it is a New Haven Unity Rally, and we're inviting people from across the city to come and to talk about how in New Haven we recognize everyone, that we don't espouse any of those neo-Nazi or white supremacist ideas, and that we are one community.
So how did this come about? Who organized it and who's involved?
Well, it came about after a discussion with Chief Campbell and
Police Chief Anthony Campbell.
Yeah. And in our discussion, we thought that it would be good if we had an ecumenical kind of look, so that we had ministers from all faiths there, people from throughout our community, and that we speak together in one voice about how we value one another.
Is it going to be more like a press conference because it's indoors? Is it a rally? What kind of are you calling out citizens to come participate?
Oh, yes, we want citizens to come and participate, and we will. It's really, I guess, more of a community statement. It's going to be hard to have chants in City Hall, but our experience
might not be the time to balance the books on the one floor above at the controller's office.
Probably not.
It's 200 Orange, but they got this. Got the finance department up in Lydia.
Yeah, they're right on the fourth floor. It's the finance department.
It does carry.
But you know, we're going to let them get a little loud. It's 3:30. It's, you know, some people have that 3 o'clock. You know, like depression. They won't have it in City Hall today.
So I got emails about this from the Jewish Federation. I mean, what kind of people have you brought in on this?
Well, we're bringing people from all religious groups, Christian ministers, people from the Muslim faith, Jewish faith. You know, hopefully we'll have some Buddhists there. And
that'll be the quiet moment to do the books. They'll lead us in a little moment of meditation, a little om. I could add numbers when I'm hearing om. Yeah.
I've invited Imani Williams, who was someone who spoke out in Boston, to come. She's a New Havener. I left word, hopefully she'll get the message and come and speak. Our alders will be there, and they'll be speaking.
Is she a New Havener who
yes,
spoke in Boston?
Uh-huh.
Who is she?
She's a New Havener. She works for Yale New Haven Hospital, and you know, she's obviously an advocate.
And what is this moment in New Haven that there's a need for this kind of community statement?
Well, I think that what we want to be able to do in a positive way is to say, these are our values, and we value one another, and we're really doing it so the rest of the state, the rest of the United States can see that this is what matters in our town.
I know people are happy about this event happening, because I know I was out of town during Charlottesville. And I saw social media, but I wasn't working. And there was a rally not held by you, by activist groups, right after Charlottesville in New Haven. And one thing I picked up a lot, because my social media tends to be people I might know, is how upset Jewish people were about the New Haven rally. that they went there and they're, you know, at this Charlottesville event where there was violence and the protests about the Confederate statue and there were Nazis organizing the rally, the chants on the street were getting rid of Jews.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was about Jews, which really threw everybody for a loop. And at this event in New Haven, not a single word was spoken about Jews in the entire event. And a lot of Jewish people had shown up for that event because they wanted to connect with the rest of the community about the pain people were feeling about Charlottesville and the fear about what's happening in this country when the President of the United States praises people who show up to a Nazi organized rally on the side of the organizers. And they left that rally feeling, and then some people spoke to protest organizers and they were apologetic and said, you know, it just didn't occur to us. What do you think about the connection there? I mean, I noticed when you said you organized this, you're trying to include all faiths. How central is that?
Well, I think it's really important. You know, when you're talking about solidarity and who we are as Americans, you've got to include everybody. And you know, we've got to remember that when you go after one specific group, you're ultimately going after all of us. You know, I have indigenous Indian ancestry, but most people in America don't. And, you know, mine is so far removed from my experience that I think probably even those folks would argue that I don't. And so from that perspective, we are all immigrants. We are all people who are really the other. And the real struggle for us as human beings, we tend to be tribal. And what this country challenges us to do, and I think what we've done so well here in New Haven, is to form a tribe that is inclusive. And it's a...
What would you call that tribe? Americans?
Yeah. What a novel idea. And that we need to stand up for it. That it really, to me, signals evolution of who it is we are as a human race. The fact that we can break away from, you know, like our tribes and then become a greater whole.
You know, trying to do that in the last couple of years of Black Lives Matters rally, people from different faiths and backgrounds have all said the violence against African Americans and the criminal justice system as it operates really hurts all of us. But the subjects and the victims and the targets have all been Black. And now when you throw Jews into the mix, this echoes a time in our nation's history that really goes back to the middle of the 20th century that we haven't seen since. I mean, Jews kind of, by and large, there's anti-Semitism around the world. They're isolated incidents in America. But we're not an oppressed minority in America. Jews have kind of made it, right? But they've still been a big part of the Civil Rights Coalition, big part of the Obama campaign, second biggest group voting for Obama after African Americans. But this kind of brings us back to a different time when the bonds between African Americans and Jews and the common interest resurfaces in a way that it hasn't in like 50 years.
Well, it's interesting to me that it has. It's interesting to me that there are a group of people in America that kept hidden these really negative ideas. And, you know, one of the things that used to disturb me when I was in the General Assembly is that we were never able to talk about these things. We had to act as if everything was all right. All of these matters had been solved.
Wow.
And so at least Charlottesville's given us an opportunity to recognize that, in fact, they haven't been solved.
So has Donald Trump given us an opportunity? Because this is a result of him. I mean, the organizers of that rally, David Duke, Richard Spencer, the white supremacist leaders, Klansmen, praised Donald Trump's public comments about this, saying, you've encouraged us. We're out here to fulfill the president's agenda. The president publicly said, I don't like Nazis, but he basically agreed with them about the Confederate memorials and said the people who showed up to that rally were basically good people.
Well, I think that the president's position is a disgrace to his office. And really, frankly, beyond that his understanding of what it means to be a human being. So I think that, yes, he has let the lid off, and now we can at least talk about it. But it's disgraceful that he did that.
Okay. Well, I'd like to get back to this after we take this call from Bob.
Hey, Bob.
It's Mayor Monday. We're on WNHH Radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Bob has dialed the following number, 203-8727-ELM. 203-872-7356. You can call Two and Beyond, or as on previous weeks, you can send us questions via the Facebook page of the New Haven Independent, where you can find the live stream of this show. Hi, Bob. How you doing, sir?
Hey, Paul. Welcome back.
And thank you, Mister.
Hey, welcome Bob. Back to you, too. I have a few questions for you, stems, I guess, around the state budget. My first question is, are you going to follow suit like other small mayors have in their towns?
Did you call her a small mayor?
Having a spending and hiring freeze?
I say you're going to have a hiring freeze.
No.
I thought you already did.
We don't. We're not having a hiring freeze of everybody. We're getting ready to hire a bunch of police officers and firefighters. For those positions that we don't absolutely need, we're going to be very judicious in terms of hiring, but we are going to continue to hire our police and
yeah, I fire. Thought you said that you had a new hire freeze except for police and fire.
Well, that's not a hiring freeze.
Okay, a partial hiring freeze. Okay, good point. You know? Didn't you also announce that you're going to not enter into new contracts?
Yes.
Except on an emergency basis until the state gets a budget?
Yes, exactly. We're
and Bob,
do that.
Yesterday, there was a mayoral debate yesterday. It was originally billed as a forum, but I think we can all agree it was a debate. What do you think?
Okay.
Felt like a debate.
And, yeah, and anyway, at that debate, Bob, Mayor Harp did announce that New Haven was made whole on education funding. So Governor Malloy is about to tell, he issued an order that if there's no state budget by October 1st, that the majority, almost all the towns in Connecticut will either have their education cost sharing money, meaning the money they get for schools from the state, completely eliminated or drastically reduced. But the cities are getting their money intact, and New Haven's $38.57 million they got last year will be coming again. And I did confirm that after the debate with Benjamin Barnes, the state budget chief, and he said that's all solid. Yeah.
The city is also getting the education money, aren't they?
That's what I just said, yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, I can't hear you that well.
No problem.
Okay.
Did you have another question, Bob?
Yeah, I guess my question stems from an incident that happened at Public Works with an employee.
Oh, right.
I wanted to hear the mayor's response to that and if the city is looking into it. I understand one of the employees have filed a lawsuit against the city.
Sure. Whenever a lawsuit is filed against the city, I don't really talk about it publicly.
What was there the general question? Because I wasn't familiar with it. I just was on vacation. I noticed the headline that a black Public Works employee said there was a hostile environment for African Americans. Do you think there's a hostile environment there in Public Works?
I've spoken to other people who work there, and they say that under the leadership of Jeff Pescasolito and others in that department, that they've had the best environment that they've had in years.
Okay, before we move on, Mayor Harp, with our long list of stuff going on in town, I'd like to return to Charlottesville, if you don't mind, for a minute. There are some interesting questions that have been raised about how we do respond to Charlottesville. And because these demonstrations take place all over the country, we got a little taste of it in New Haven with a tiny group, white supremacists, and then the reaction there. But the one question is about the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union. They defend the right of these people to march, and they have for decades. And some people who are anti-racist activists said they shouldn't. And there was had a hard time following it. There was a lawyer who used to work for the ACLU and now does human rights work, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying that it's not free speech because they're violently advocate those views. So the ACLU is helping them too much, and they should concentrate on helping progressives, basically. And then the ACLU defenders, longtime defenders, have responded that free speech has to be for everybody. No, it doesn't. It can't be violent. You shouldn't give them a permit if they have guns. You shouldn't allow them to do anything violent. But that it's important that even the views we disagree with, no matter how abhorrent, see the light of day, and that we protect their right to do that.
I think that there's a requirement that it be peaceful. And I don't think anybody is trying to silence anyone from the public debate. We're Americans. That's what we do. We work things out, even though we see things differently. And so it's just like being in a theater and calling fire when there is no fire, and whether or not that's responsible speech. And so I think that we've got to assure that it's responsible speech in Charlottesville. They have open carry laws in Virginia. People were carrying. They had bats. They had other kinds of things. They were ready to have a violent altercation. So even though they got a permit, they came there ready to do violence.
And then there's a group, a very, very small group on the left called Antifa, anti-fascists, who bring weapons of their own to these rallies, not at least usually guns, but they come wanting to fight, and then the groups on the right who want to fight with them. And we saw only a handful of them in New Haven when 150 people had a counter-protest against the white supremacist event in New Haven on July 8th. These two people from out of town, not part of the New Haven group, Antifa, they had the masks and everything. They came with, I guess, water balloons filled with I forget what. And they
paint.
Yeah, paint. And they were punching people. And so the debate that's gone on since then, it's gone on the page of the Independent today because those two people did accept a plea deal last week in court, is whether their argument is that you should have stood up to the Nazis in you know, back in the day in the 30s, and that they're committing violence, you got to stop them and with force. And other people argue, I guess the majority, that you need to be nonviolent because that gives them more of a platform. It helps their cause, and it's doing what they do. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think I would agree with your latter statement that when we made the greatest strides that we did at civil rights because of nonviolent protest, and nonviolent protest is hard. Because these people will make you angry. And I don't believe that I would be where I am today if it were not for nonviolent protest. And what nonviolence does is it holds up a mirror and says, these are the values that you have as Americans. And this is what these people are espousing. But if you turn around and do the same thing that they're doing, then nobody really wins the moral high ground.
Yeah. Okay, and so you got to speak about Charlottesville on MSNBC this weekend. You were on a program hosted by Alex Witt. Where did you record that? Did you go to Hartford?
I went to WVIT in West Hartford.
That's a schlep. Because you don't go right off 91. You got to go off the highway through Meriden and then that long kind of strip mall road, right?
Yep. And
been up there.
So I went up there, and it's their main television station.
Oh, wait, I was thinking FSB. No, I think that was.
No, it's right around, it's right across from West Farms Mall.
Yep.
So you were right. Yeah, so you go up 91, get off on 9, go 9, then you get off on.
but then you got to be on national TV talking about Charlottesville. What did they ask you, and what did you say?
Well, you know, I'm the current president of the African American Mayors Association, and the African American Mayors Association has a 5-point plan, and we talked a little bit about the 5-point plan, and basically the 5-point plan includes urging all cities, state legislatures to remove symbols of the Confederacy, of Nazism, and other white supremacist group symbols from public places. And we commend New Orleans, Baltimore, Lexington, and other cities for having done that. We also called upon President Trump to remove Sebastian Gorka, Stephen Miller from their positions in his administration because of their ideological extremism that emboldens white supremacists and other hate groups. There's also funding called the Countering Violent Extremism Funds that are normally available to combat white supremacist groups, neo-Nazis, and we want that to be continued and be available to local police departments, and we also want them to provide to local law enforcement the kinds of tools that they need to fight these large marches, events that may create violence, so that our police officers need to be trained. They also need to have the resources to manage these protests. And then the other thing that we call on is what we call corporate accountability, and that's a call to boycott caught all companies and vendors that advertise on radical websites, and to urge all elected officials to work to influence companies to address ways to limit hate speech on their platforms.
Okay, there you got the five-prong platform.
Yep.
MSNBC heard it. You've heard it here on WNHH Radio's Mayor Monday program with Mayor Tony Harp at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Switching gears, we have a mayoral campaign going. I'm not going to ask you campaign questions. What I wanted to ask you about was, so you have an opponent, Marcus Packer, who petitioned his way onto the primary ballot. So you'll have a September 12th primary, Democratic. Then he gets a second shot in a general election because he's petitioned on that ballot. And what really interested me was the primary, the petition process. So it's really hard to get on the Democratic Party ballot and incredibly easy to get on the general election ballot. We've evolved how our rules evolve. So you needed 1,850 and some odd signatures approved of registered Democrats to qualify for the ballot in a Democratic primary in a citywide election, not just PACA, but the candidates for probate court. And you have only 2 weeks to do that. You have to do that between the time that the Democratic Party holds its convention to endorse the candidate, and they endorsed you, and then by this deadline in August. And that's not much time. It is really hard to get that number of signatures.
Well, I think you have to show that you can at least organize well enough to get that done, that you have enough support to do it. You can't, it's very difficult to do by yourself, but, you know, not impossible.
But then to get on the general election ballot, which theoretically involves a lot more voters, it's tiny, 122. I mean, some alders needed only 3 or 4 signatures. There was one alder who collected only 10. 6 of which were invalid, weren't people lived in their ward, and just managed to get over the 3 deadline. I mean, you basically have to go down to breakfast and ask everyone in your house to sign you're on. So it seems like we have 2 extremes here.
Yeah, it does seem that way. But I think that they look at the Democratic enrollment for our city and the number of individuals who come out and vote who are largely Democratic. And I think that's why it's weighted in that way.
But isn't it that parties make their own rules? Like, so it's 5% of the Democratic enrollment is what you need for the primary, but only 1% or less of the general electorate for the general. I mean, that's what kind of struck me, because like you always have these people run in the general election who don't plan to win, who don't have any organization, and people wonder, is that a waste of taxpayer time? Should you have to, as you just said a moment ago, show, and this has nothing to do with this year's election and these candidates, just the theory of what we want with this process. In a general election, we're not really asking them to prove they have any organizational ability, any support. We're willing to have them have everyone in. And so we've had a lot of elections, really the only people running for mayor were the incumbent and then someone who's just having a lark and doesn't really run and shows up at debate and doesn't really add that much. And then in the primary, you got people who might not get on because you have only 2 weeks and you have this really, really hard hurdle that requires, you could be a legitimate person who has a lot to say and some experience to add to the debate and have some support and not make the ballot.
Well, that's true. Although most people who are serious candidates too, I've had to do it in my life over the past while. I had to do it when I ran for Senate the first time. It was 90,000 overall people and had to get,
that's right, you had 2 city, West Haven and New Haven.
Yeah. And had to get at least 1,400 signatures. So, you know, it's hard, but it's doable.
And then a lot get removed because like people, you know, don't realize that you have to write the name a certain way sometimes, or the person has to live in the district. They might not know the rules. The person you're talking to can be confused. So many people get confused about their voting status.
I think so. And you know what happened too? I think the state required that the registrar of voters take off the active list people who've been inactive for many years, meaning that they haven't come out to vote.
2 federal elections and everything in between.
Yeah.
And haven't sent back a postcard saying they're still living where they are.
Right.
And so we got 25,000 people off the list.
So a lot of people are off, but you know, my guess is they'll be back on during this election.
So that didn't mean you had to get fewer. And it is a good process to get out there and collect signatures and
It gives you a chance to talk to people about.
Back in 1980, when I was a college kid, I worked at, my only petitioning campaign was for a presidential candidate, third party named Barry Commoner, who was an environmentalist.
Oh.
And boy, did I learn a lot fast at 20 years old. And we went all over the state. We needed 30,000 signatures because somebody got removed at the local, you know, register our voters. And you know, it was more, that was more, not quite double what you need. But we got on, but it was really interesting. And that was real campaigning, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll never forget that experience. And how about tennis? So tennis tournament starting this week, the Connecticut
all
Open.
Right. We're so excited about that. It starts, actually, I think it starts today. And they had an event yesterday that was nice, an initial event. And so it's going to go on all week. And
how much do you get to check it out?
You know, I'm going to have a couple of events there. We're going to try to get developers and small businesses together.
What day is that?
There, I believe that's Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And Wednesday, I'm going to have a luncheon for women leaders across our city and our state.
Okay.
And
we talked about that the other day because there was some criticism of the city adding support in addition to the state of $100,000 extra for this tournament. You're saying it's partly about the sport and having something fun in town and partly about an opportunity to showcase New Haven and do some business.
I think it, I absolutely. And I've seen numbers as high as $14 million worth of synergies that this brings into our city. And so to invest $100,000, I think is extra, because I think we were investing $100,000, so it's $200,000. Is I think it's well worth it for us.
Then they always say, Mrs. Lincoln, how'd you like the show? How about the tennis? Do you like the tennis?
I do. I really like the tennis. I think it's a very interesting sport. And the other thing that we are able to do is to, through the Connecticut Tennis Foundation, is to expose a lot of young people in New Haven to tennis after school and in the summer.
What I like is the nighttime. I've always liked that stadium at night, especially in the summer, because you don't have the hot sun beating on you. And you're watching this game, which is always interesting to watch the two or the four contestants, how they're doing it over a series of a couple of sets and you know, endurance and strategy. And it's quiet. It's an interesting way to experience sport in a public spectacle where you hear them grunting.
I was going to say, except for the grunts.
Yeah. Well, the grunts are interesting.
They are
kind of human, and it echoes. And even though they have to do a lot of promotion around it, the giveaways and stuff to make it fun for people, during the match itself, I find that there's something both dignified and primal at the same time watching a tennis match. I don't think I'm going to be able to make it this year. I always like going like one night match and watching them. You know, you wonder, they come from the different countries from all over the world to play. Yeah.
No, I think it's really very.
There was an incoming Yale freshwoman played this year.
Oh, okay. That's
she,
great.
Yeah. I forget where she was from, but she got her first chance. I think she got eliminated, but she was excited to play. So one thing that gets us on the map. Now, you also went to a dog shelter event, the Robin Krugman Dog Shelter, named after the late Fairhaven Alder Robin Krugman, who was elected the same year you were.
Sure, we served
1987,
together.
1987 on the Board of Alders. Yep. It was the women's year when you and Liz McCormick and Elaine Branfman and Robin Krugman, 1987, all came on the board at a time when it wasn't as much as a given about women in elected office.
Mm-hmm.
You actually replaced a woman, but the others, for the most part, I think, replaced men. And but Robin's sadly dead, but she cared a lot about dogs. So what was this event about, and what's the Robin Krugman Animal Shelter?
Well, it was one of the things that it was about was to bring out some dogs who need homes, so that it was an opportunity to meet dogs and some cats to see whether or not you would be interested in taking them home with you.
Where was this?
It was on Broadway.
On that island there?
Yeah, on the island, the Broadway Island. And it was also an opportunity to meet some of the vendors or store owners on Broadway. Origins was out there. They had cookies. and so one of the cookie bakers that's over there was out there. And it was an opportunity to donate to the Robin Krugman Animal Shelter. So they were asking for $20. And it helps to build funds that help support the animal shelter. It's a city function, but all of the extras come from those funds.
Is that the one on Fournier Street, or is it
somewhere else?
Okay, so it's a city shelter. And you have a dog.
I have a dog. My daughter has a dog, so Technically, I have two dogs.
But the daughter doesn't live here.
Yes, she does.
Oh, she does.
My oldest daughter lives here. Yeah, she moved back last year.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So what kind of dog?
Australian Shepherd and a Cocker Spaniel.
And do you walk it every day?
Yes, I do. Walk it every day, every morning, every evening.
I kind of figured that when your kids grow up, maybe like I didn't want a dog because I don't want to have that responsibility after, you know, you're done with kids.
But well, it's kind of like having similar responsibility, but you know, they're also very interesting and loving, loving creatures. So it's great to have them in
the other thing that happened is that for the first time, we had first year, we had a professional soccer team in New Haven, the Elm City Express.
Yes.
And they won their league championship two weekends ago in Westville.
Yeah.
And they play at a stadium. They get pretty good crowds, I'm told, at Reese Stadium. What?
Well, you know, I think we're really excited. I know Andy Wolf of my staff has really been on top of this and has gone to a lot of the games. I talked to Adam Marchand this morning, and he was saying
Westville Alder. Yeah.
Yeah, he was saying he took his son to almost all of his sons to almost all of the games. It was very exciting. You know, there's a lot of amateur soccer in New Haven, so I think that that's where they get their crowds from. People who are here playing amateur soccer want to see professional soccer as well. And so nobody thought that their first year out that they would win their league.
People
so,
are excited about that as they want to each stage the semifinals.
Yeah.
Because sports has had a rough time in New Haven except for college sports. We went from, I think, at one point, double A to single A to pre-single A. Baseball teams, that all went out of business. The hockey league, same thing. It all went out of business. Arts flourished here. You know, we have a thriving entertainment city. But it was interesting to see, and I'm wondering if that's partly about the international cast of our city now, because we have these thriving soccer leagues on the Boulevard, for instance, on the weekends.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. They're on the Boulevard. They also play, I think, over in the East Shore. And you know, in the summertime, it's really hard to get space for almost anything else because they're there. They also play in the wintertime in our school gymnasiums, which I can't imagine. That's got to be pretty tough on if you ever fall, you know. But at any rate, it's very important to many of the people who live here in New Haven as well as in the region. And so it was really wise of who decided to come and do a professional team here because of the interest.
All right. And Aaron Good had an interest in asking you a question posted on Facebook Live here. Would the mayor accept cross-endorsement by the Working Families Party? Does she think the Working Family Party should run its own progressive candidates in New Haven municipal races? So Working Families Party is set up pretty much everywhere but New Haven in Connecticut. All the cities, smaller cities even, I think they're in like 12 or more ballot lines where they most, I think in New Britain or somewhere, they're running their own candidates. But in general, they cross-endorse progressive Democrats. This year, they have a candidate on the ballot in the general election. It's not just you and Marcus Paca. Sarah Ganong, who is a young organizer with the Working Families Party, has made the ballot to run for mayor. She said she does not want to be in debates. She does not want to be the mayor. I asked her if she'd fix my sidewalk. She did not make any promises. Luckily, it has already been fixed. But basically, that's a strategy question. She said if we get 1% of the vote, then we have this line. And we could do what we do in Hartford. We could do what we do in Bridgeport. We could do what we do in Danbury and Norwalk and Waterbury. And that's to endorse Democrats in future elections. They do this all over the country. What's your take on it? Aaron wondered whether you would accept that cross-endorsement if you think they should run their own progressive candidates.
No, I would accept it. I accepted a cross-endorsement from the Green Party when I first started.
At your first election in 87.
Yeah. Yep.
The Progressive Coalition.
And I think it's important in our city that we actually have the Working Families Party doing cross endorsement, especially of our alders. We have a hard time getting that third party in, and there are some things like our bond committee that really needs that third party. So what the Board of Alders did was to elect someone to be the third party representative.
Who's a Democrat.
Who's a Democrat.
Masquerading as a Republican.
Well, I don't know if it's masquerading.
No, legally. Legally, I mean, it was Sarah Idelson, who's a Democrat, but because you had all of them were Democrat. So does that mean, but if they're cross-endorsed, it's not the same thing, they'd still be a Democrat. They'd still be registered as Democrat. I think what Aaron Good is asking is it, because they're not a third party the way other third parties are. So you have the Green Party, where people register as a Green, they run as a Green, if they win, they're in the Green Party. The Working Families Party, except in some cities. takes Democrats who are running as Democrats, like Rosa DeLauro gets cross-endorsed by them all the time. Dan Malloy got cross-endorsed by him. Chris Murphy. They endorse other Democrats, except in some limited cities. So I think what Aaron's asking, and I think you make a good point here, if they ran their own candidate, if they register, or maybe they could not run their own candidates, but register their own members so that you could register in New Haven as a Working Families Party.
Right, right.
And that happened in Hartford, because Hartford has a law, right, that on their city council, 3 of the 9 members have to be members of another party. So in the past, that was always the top 3 Republican vote getters, but then Working Families people started getting it, and they even got, I think, a register of voters.
Right. So I think
so. That would help you.
That would help us. That would help our city. So that there would be some.
Now, would a
diversity.
Cynic say that would just be more Democrats masquerading as minor party? Like right now, you appoint Republicans to commissions. They do bring another point of view. I know that you're enthusiastic about that. You work with Jonathan Wharton, down chair, to identify people. Like he has very much spoken up as a city planning commission member against Democratic ideas about development or unionization. If you got a Working Families Party member, the pressure would come from the other side. It'd be from the left of the Democratic Party.
I think that it's really important to have a third party of some sort on our board of alders, and it could be a working family person that's endorsed by the working family, a member of the Working Family Party, because there are some things that we're required to do with the board of alders that require 3 parties, and we just... So
I guess my question is it, like when you ran in 87 or most of their people like Rosa, you're still registered as a Democrat. So would that fall under the minority party requirement?
Well, I think that it might if you could be registered.
So the Democrats can endorse somebody who's registered as a Working Family Party member.
I think so. Yeah.
But in any case, you still have all these other appointments you make.
Sure. Yes.
So if you have Working Families Party and you have members, you can appoint them to the Development Commission. You can appoint them to City Plan. You can appoint them to Zoning.
Right.
Fire Commission and things like that. And you brought up Andy Wolfe, your cultural czar. We can't not mention before we leave the Opera Palooza.
That's wonderful.
So you had your second annual big event on the Green,
yep,
where you get all these young opera singers, and they each do one aria, and the crowd is told what the aria is about, and the orchestra plays behind them, and you get tons of Italian and food on the Green. Mm-hmm. So did you go this year?
I did.
It was this past Saturday on the Green. What was it like?
It was really great. A lot of people were out there. It's a different kind of opportunity on the Green than we have had prior to having this. This was our second year. And one really great thing is that Tomas Reyes, who is my chief of staff, his stepson was...
Charlie Widmer, he was in here singing.
He was singing. That's right. He sang an aria on Saturday night. He was excellent.
He's got chops.
He does. He's got stage presence. He's really.
And you
really
saw him a week earlier than that, 2 weeks at Cafe 9 doing R&B.
Yeah.
What was the difference?
Different sound to the voice. I mean, he's got a very trained classical singer, but then he can also sort of like have that raspy rock and roll thing going on too. So it's very different. It's like 2 different people in one.
So another issue that's been brought up in town lately, Mayor Harp, is smaller apartments.
Yep.
And I think this is included. So one of the newest proposals downtown is at the Union, which is the old bank building, Union Trust building with a couple on top of it at Elm and Church. They've built that into new apartments. They're leased, they're expensive, they're successful. They got a parking lot next to it. And they've got plans now to put a 3-story garage with other apartments on top of it. And then one floor within the 105 apartments, one floor of hotel rooms, extended stay, kind of a mix.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, aren't they talking about 400 square foot apartments there? Or?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I've seen some other articles about people building 400 square foot in-law.
Or 300, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, my concern about the really, if it's a hotel in there and it's extended stay and there are people there to keep it up from a sanitary point of view, then I think that's reasonable. I think that when we start talking about squeezing people into 300 square foot housing in communities and have no real way of maintaining the standard of that housing, I become a little worried about that.
Mm-hmm. Other news item happened, the Goodrich Boys, which I didn't even know it existed, a gang in New Hallville.
Mm-hmm.
The local police working with the federal government on Project Longevity arrested six people they say are key people in that gang who were responsible for shootings, attempted murders, and drug dealing. And that was done through that Project Longevity program that unites federal and local law enforcement so that they daily share intelligence and strategies. And in addition, give people a chance that if they don't want to be arrested in these gangs to look at the evidence against them and go straight and get help. The Stacy Spell is the retired New Haven cop who was a point person for the community at Project Longevity. And he's been working without pay now for a couple of months, I believe it is, because the state doesn't have a budget. Are you concerned about that? What's going to happen with that situation?
Yeah, I'm really concerned about it. In my discussions with Chief Campbell, Project Longevity has been key to our keeping our crime down, our homicides down. As you know, there have been five so far this year, whereas in Hartford, there have been 20. And so
20. How about Bridgeport?
19.
Ooh.
And so we're doing something right here, and I would not want to disturb that at all. So I'm hoping that there are ways that our legislature can move very quickly to, one, continue to fund them and to understand how critically important it is as a tool for us in this city.
It's interesting. They have Project Longevity, too, in Hartford and Bridgeport.
They do, but
I wonder why it's worked better here.
I've asked the Chief Campbell that, and we use it slightly differently than they do. We use it prospectively, and I think they may use it retrospectively.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't. The whole program is supposed to be prospective, where you're kind of mapping who are the people most likely to do violence and who's popping up on both sides' radar and stuff.
Yeah, for some reason, they don't exactly implement it in the same way that we do. And that's what I was told. So.
And there's been a compromise in the great democracy parking debate. Jeanette Morrison and Dixwell Alder wanted people to be able to park for free if they come to public meetings on Monday through Thursday nights. But she wanted it on the street and on Church Street. And your traffic guy, Doug Houseland, thought those would be taken instead by people with other business downtown, that it wouldn't promote democracy and that we'd lose too much revenue. In the end, there was a compromise struck at the Traffic Authority, which I love because it's also the police commission. So they have the first meeting, Traffic Authority, and they say, meeting's over. Then the very same people say, meeting starting again. I think it's like a Woody Allen movie. But anyway, what they said is they're going to open up a lot on 40 Elm Street near Orange, where you can park for free at a public meeting, or in a Yale lot if it's still open on Temple Street, across from the public library, the after hours. Theirs is open too. It sometimes fills up. Do you think that's going to work? One concern I had is whether people are, this whole process that's a little bureaucratic, you have to get, for the Elm Street lot, you have to get it stamped, some kind of form. And then when you're at the meeting, you got to find someone to approve it and all that kind of stuff.
I think that makes it probably difficult. And even though there is that in place for people, I think people are going to feel like there's not much in place for them. Mm-hmm. I think it's far easier for people to just make a decision that on Church Street and maybe Elm Street, that particularly on aldermanic nights, that we don't enforce parking.
Okay. And then in Westfield, there were 85 ash borers, many of them in Westville, though some citywide. There's some kind of disease that's the borer that's going into it, and that it started in another country. It came to Detroit.
How did it get
spread
from
across
Detroit?
The country? I don't know. It started in Detroit. Motown came from Detroit, and so did the Emerald Ash Borer. And now all these trees. So there's been a little bit. People get so passionate about trees. I wouldn't want to be the tree warden, Becky Bombero. Because people get so upset when you're taking down trees, and sometimes because you haven't taken them down fast enough, they're worried it's going to fall in their house. And other times because they love their trees and it gives them shade. And so she has, 85 were targeted. And then there was an uprising somewhat by some of the mild. And some people in Westville, and they came and talked to her and yelled about it. And they decide in the end that if a tree is less than 30% gone, it can be saved if the neighbor is willing to adopt the tree and maybe help to pay for that upkeep. And in fact, my next door neighbor did that.
Oh, wow.
This morning. He was out there. You got the company doing it, but that the others need to go. And they kind of came out with that list. Anything, everything. I remember when you first ran, actually, trees was one of your first issues. Remember that?
Yep.
For Alder, I'm talking about in 87.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was really surprised. I walked the Coharie track. And I was looking at all of these. I noticed that there was paper on trees, and then I finally went to read it. And they were taking down, I would say, about over half of the trees on this on the street that I walk on, which is Coharie Drive and then up to Stevenson. And
oh, you get a little bit of a workout. That's a big hill.
Yeah, it is. And I was like really surprised by that, but they gave people an opportunity to come to a hearing if they felt that something different should happen. So I'm glad that that process happened for people. And I was really concerned that so many trees, it would have changed the whole character of that neighborhood.
The trees that give us the shade in the summer.
Yeah.
They help conserve energy in the winter, and they're pretty.
Yeah.
I mean, we are the Elm City. So the big question, thinking about climate, I don't know if you saw, but that 8 Thimble Islands are for sale, and they're for $50 million. The price has dropped $28 million.
Wow.
Christine Svenningsen, who's the rich woman who owns those islands, wants to dump them. My question is, do you want to spend that money by those islands, or is climate change going to make even that a terrible price? Will those islands even exist in 10 years?
I think we need to worry about whether or not they'll exist. But for those people who are just, you know, they're older and they want to enjoy them for now, for the next 5 or 6 years, and they have enough money, maybe it's not a bad price.
So there you got it. The mayor of New Haven weighing in on the Thimble Islands, on Charlottesville, on trees, on public, on petitioning to get on ballots, to state aid, and back from MSNBC. It's so nice to check in with you every Monday, Mayor Harp. Thanks for coming by.
All right, great. Good seeing you. I'm glad you had a great vacation.
Yep, it's nice to see you. And thanks to Bertram Moses and Gateway Community College for providing support for today's show. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free from the CD A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass reminding us all that we do know what it feels like to be free. We just have to book our flight. Book your flight. Fly free with us all day and night long here at WNHH, your home for community radio.